The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to part two of my coverage on Bill Mowbray. I'm again joined by Elise from the True Crime Cat Lawyer podcast. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Susie's trial and eventual acquittal.
So Susie's son, Wade, just couldn't let it go. When his mother was first arrested and charged, he was 16, and he was living in Shreveport, Louisiana with his father. Obviously, his mother was in jail, so he went to live with his dad. So while his mom was serving her prison sentence, he was growing up and he decided he would go to law school. He was able to request copies of the trial testimony and other trial notes. He reviewed all this information over and over and started interviewing people in the community, friends, family, basically anybody who knew his mom and his stepdad. So 5 months into this review, he found evidence contradicting the state's expert witness, Heskew, regarding the blood spatter found on the nightgown. So based on this contradictory evidence, he filed an appeal on behalf of Susie and a hearing was held. At this hearing, Heskew actually admitted that his blood spatter testimony in the first trial was invalid because no follow-up testing had been done.
Oof, that's kind of a big blow to the case, isn't it?
It is. And I think there are some ways you could get around this being a big deal. But in Susie's case, the nightgown was the central piece of evidence in this prosecution's case. So for your so-called expert to say that their testing wasn't valid, not a good look.
No, it's not a good look. Doesn't it so often happen in cases where the evidence looks pretty sound otherwise? Won't a judge often look at it and go, I see that you got this wrong and I acknowledge that this is wrong, but it's not enough for a new trial type of a thing.
Right. It's sort of the reasonable minds can differ kind of argument. But they also had the other lab technicians who testified at trial admit that there was no scientific support for their testimony.
Oh, yikes. You've got scientists and lab techs saying, nothing scientific here, just totally subjective. We're, not following any scientific method and, nothing's peer reviewed here. We're just going for it. And we're giving opinions based on nothing science related. That does not look good.
Yeah. So, of course, with all of these quote-unquote scientists making these statements under oath, the judge ruled that without Heskew's testimony, there was another equally reasonable hypothesis other than Susie's guilt, and that was that Bill's death was either a suicide or an accident. So, in December of 1996, Susie was granted a new trial based on the testimony provided by the experts, as well as what we talked about earlier, the prosecution's suppression of McDonald's report in her original trial.
Do you call that suppression when someone just waits till the last minute? They did hand it over, right?
They did. So I think it goes back to kind of what you were alluding to earlier in dumping all of these documents on a person kind of at the last minute kind of thing. I think from what it sounded like, nobody ever said this explicitly, but from what it sounded like, they didn't really know that this report existed. And because the prosecution never called McDonald, they never really had the chance to kind of flesh that out. And I'm not really sure why they didn't call him as a witness, but I think it really was that report was just buried somewhere. And they either didn't have time to get to it or didn't look for it. Something happened to where they didn't use that report in some way.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you're dumping a bunch of documents on people at the 11th hour, they're in the middle of trial preparation, And maybe they don't have the team behind them to be going through thousands of pages when it's only a couple weeks prior to when they're starting. So it makes sense that it was carefully orchestrated on the part of the prosecution, potentially, just so that maybe that report wouldn't be found.
Right. And I don't know that the defense's strategy was what the prosecution's was. And by that, I mean that they really were focused on showing that Bill committed suicide. And so I don't know that the blood spatter evidence or testimony was really that crucial to them insofar as kind of discrediting that testimony.
Yeah, it feels like in going forward with the expert that they went forward with, that was a really poor choice. That they should have, if they were going to make the nightgown a point of contention and make it such a central focus, they should have covered their bases and made sure that they were using the international expert if they were going to use anybody at all. It just was a really poorly calculated move on the part of the prosecution, unfortunately.
So the second trial began in January 1998. Heskew was again forced to admit on the stand that his original trial testimony was scientifically invalid.
Oh, this reminds me of that Netflix documentary where they go into bite mark evidence and I think maybe fiber evidence, and they go into blood spatter and how these things all result in so many wrongful convictions. And some of the experts, it's just ridiculous how much they vary. It doesn't mean that there aren't some people out there who could be considered experts. It's just that there's so much subjectivity attached to these subsets of forensic science.
And I think when you're sort of presenting a case that has forensics, most of the people out there probably don't understand forensics. I'll be the first to admit I don't understand all forensics.
Me neither.
So what you're really relying on is the experts to provide the testimony that is scientific. You know, anybody off of the street could come in and testify and say, oh, I think that that's blood, and, you know, just say whatever they want. You're not going to be qualified as an expert because you have no basis for that opinion.
It's like in The Staircase, the guy who was a blood spatter expert was like not really an expert and he should not have been testifying. And it's muddied the waters of the case, you know?
Exactly. And so I feel like when you're presenting this testimony at the first trial, and then by the time it gets to the second trial, this so-called expert is getting on the stand and saying the words scientifically invalid.
Yeah.
You've definitely just lost the jury on his opinion, rightfully so, because his testing and his expertise is supposed to be scientific.
I mean, how embarrassing for Heskew, too, to have to get up repeatedly and to admit that the testing he was using was not scientific. It just doesn't even make sense why you would want to get up there and share your findings. I'm assuming that it was sort of like that pick me type energy, like, look what I've done, and I'm going to support your conclusion of murder. And the evidence wasn't there, but he kind of just, he didn't fabricate it, but he interpreted it in a way that was definitely not scientific.
Yes. And I think Brett and Alice from the Prosecutors podcast have said this several times in their episodes, that you can pay anybody to say whatever you want them to say. Like, if you pay enough money, you can always find somebody to agree with you.
Oh, yeah.
That's such a dangerous thing because you want people to present the best scientific evidence that they possibly can. Like in this case, it should have been McDonald that was providing the blood spatter report, regardless of whether he supported that or not. That's who you went with to begin with. You know, you shouldn't be allowed to sort of quote unquote shop for experts just to find somebody that's going to agree with what you want them to.
Well, because some people have ethics that aren't exactly malleable. And maybe it's a case where you could argue it either way. And so they're like a hired gun and they come in and they're like, okay, one could interpret it this way or this way. So I'm going to choose to interpret it this way. And I don't see that as any ethical violation. And then you could have some experts that are like, I don't care what conclusion you want me to reach, I'll reach it. But then others who are going to come in and be like, eh, I don't see what you see. I see the opposite. So I can't in good conscience go along with what you want me to say. So I guess in a situation like that, are they going to be forced to use an expert that is saying the opposite of what they say? But it should be put into evidence, right? That they did do this, or they did hire this expert, and this expert had findings opposite to which they did. And then it would give the defense or prosecution, depending on the opportunity, to use that expert to their advantage. But yeah, the shopping for experts is difficult, right? Because there seems to be people out there who are willing to say anything for a buck.
Right. And I think that the big problem in this case, in her original trial, was that there wasn't the presenting of the competing experts. So again, whether this was because of the suppression or because the defense just dropped the ball, whatever it is, they definitely changed strategies for the second trial. And so they called McDonald to testify for the defense. And he told the jury that it was more likely that Bill committed suicide based on his review of the nightgown and the other blood spatter evidence. So along with, you know, this sort of discrediting of Heskew, they also then brought in McDonald to sort of have both of the quote unquote experts, one who is clearly not an expert and has been, I think, well discredited through his testimony, but then to also sort of bring this person that is well known and respected. I mean, you want somebody who is internationally renowned and has testified in these big trials. You want somebody like that to testify for you.
Yeah, it's sort of like the case with sniffer dogs. It very much depends on the handler, and the training isn't the same across the board. So when you get somebody to testify, you want to make sure that person is the very best in their field, because not all sniffer dogs are created equally, and all handlers definitely aren't either. And I think that's the same with blood spatter analysis, because when there is no standard as to what exactly an expert is, I think it depends on which state you're in, right? It's not like some standardized thing all across the US, which makes you a blood spatter expert. You can get very little education and call yourself an expert in that field.
So, like we kind of talked about earlier, the initial theory for the prosecution in the first trial was that Susie had straddled Bill and then shot him. Well, they kind of abandoned that theory by the time of the second trial. And their new theory was that Susie shot Bill from behind the pillow wall and argued that there's no way Bill could have possibly shot himself because he was in that normal sleeping position they found him in, where he was covered with a blanket, and then there was no blood or gunshot residue or brain matter on his right hand.
Yeah, I thought it was weird that they settled on this Susie was straddling Bill because of all the reasons we listed earlier. Bill would have an opportunity to fight back. He would likely stir. It wouldn't make sense with the position he was found in. So shooting him behind the pillow wall makes a lot more sense.
It does. It's like you said, if you're sort of wanting to do this in the least reactive way possible, doing it while he's sleeping and is defenseless is, for lack of a better term, the perfect time to do it, because if he's sleeping, he's not going to see it coming. If you're behind him from this pillow wall, again, he's not going to see it coming. So he's not going to have a chance to fight back, try to grab the gun from you. It's going to be, quote unquote, as clean as possible.
Yeah, I think from a strategic point of view, and if we're to believe that Susie did this, she's likely a planner, that would seem like the best plan. To straddle him would seem like there's a lot of opportunity for some kind of blowback, for some kind of defense where he realizes that she's doing something and he changes his position and it becomes very obvious that it wasn't indeed Bill who died by his own hand. It was Susie who's responsible. So yeah, the pillow wall thing, shooting through that. Yeah, I definitely can buy that that was the position she was in.
So on top of discrediting the prosecution's witnesses and having McDonald testify, the defense continued to push the financial and emotional mental problems that Bill had. So they actually brought a banker who was not part of the first trial, who testified that 2 days before Bill's death, Bill had begged and pleaded for a loan from him, and he vowed to commit suicide if he didn't get that loan.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
It is. So, of course, the banker wasn't able to give him the loan because he already had those two loans on the dealership. And from everything I gathered, he wasn't even supposed to have those two. He was only supposed to have one. So there was no way he was going to get this loan. So he basically told this banker, if you don't give me this loan, I'm going to kill myself.
But one thing I don't buy, though, is if he did, I believe that he said that, sure. And I believe that, sure, that could have been the sentiment. But if he was going to do that, going to end his own life, I would think that he would change the policy from his estranged wife being the beneficiary, who, you know, the nature of their relationship at that moment seems to be kind of a matter of opinion because Bill isn't here to tell us exactly what was going on. But it feel like he would have changed the beneficiary to Kristen if that was his intent to end his own life, given the fact that they were only talking about dividing their assets at this point, right?
Right. And something else that was mentioned is that, like you said, the beneficiary hadn't been changed, even though there were many people, including the insurance company, that said that that was his plan and his intent to change it. They're also... he's got this plan going in motion, but then he doesn't have any plan for how to conduct his business and like what should happen to that afterwards. Like, he didn't leave a note. He didn't leave any kind of plan or instructions about his business. So not everybody does, for sure, when a suicide happens. But given that he's already attempted and contemplated suicide once before, and he's already making these other plans, it seems like he would be someone who would have something kind of set in motion for what happens after he's gone.
I feel like if he's going to make the effort to do this and to make the decision to end his life, it seems like from everything we know about Bill that he would put some kind of plan or, you know, protocols in place where he's like, this is what will happen in the event of my death. And so it gives his daughter a little more guidance. How exactly he felt towards Susie at this point in time, I guess, is up for debate because we really don't know. We only have Susie to go on. So it's a little bit difficult, but I just have a hard time believing that he, because this isn't an impulsive suicide if it was indeed a suicide, because we have him using this as a tactic in order to help secure this loan. And then he doesn't get the loan. So if we're to believe that this is planned out, it seems like a really strange way to go about it if that was indeed what happened.
I don't necessarily buy some of the arguments they were trying to make about why this is suicide versus murder or accident. So during closing arguments, Susie decided she would have an outburst in the courtroom and she yelled to the jury, quote, I didn't do it.
Okay. That's so dramatic. Outbursts from defendants such as that. It just seems so much against advice of your attorney, because outbursts like that don't typically help you. But it seems like it's something that somebody is doing in almost a way of being manipulative to the jury. Like, oh, only an innocent person would cry out in the courtroom, I didn't do it.
Exactly. And so, like you said, she was obviously removed from the courtroom until she could calm down, because no judge likes that. And in the Oxygen special I watched, one of the friends and former attorneys of Bill's that was kind of there along watching the trial, she said that it seemed like the jury, they didn't take it well. It seemed really fake to them. And so they were kind of put off by it, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think that it was one of those things that it's like calling his business partner before she called 911. It's just a poorly calculated decision. It doesn't feel like a genuine outburst of emotion. Because I feel like if you were going to have a genuine outburst of emotion like that, it should have happened at the first trial.
And I don't know that screaming, I didn't do it, is ever helpful, because we're just, it's been so ingrained into us that defendants always say they didn't commit the crime. So you trying to tell me that in your trial doesn't mean anything, because like everybody says they didn't do it, you know?
Yeah. I feel like if that's the case, then that you really didn't do it. I feel like this intense emotion that's behind this. I mean, this has been, you know, years in the make now. This isn't like this fresh reaction after the death of Bill and she's just so upset by it. It just, the protracted outburst of emotion, just, it doesn't, makes it in my mind more likely that it's disingenuous. And yeah, I didn't do it. It's not a good argument for somebody not doing it because everybody says they didn't do it.
Exactly. And everybody says I didn't do it. I don't think anybody wants to go to jail. So of course I'm going to say I didn't do it.
Yeah, I think people will do and say anything not to go to jail. And at this point, she's like, okay, I've seen what prison can be like. I want to get out of here. And, you know, my son's gone to law school. He believes wholeheartedly in my innocence. So let me kind of do what I can here. And I'm sure that he did not advise her to do that.
So the jury did initially have some trouble with deliberations, but the judge asked them to kind of go back to the drawing board and really see if they could come to a decision. And on January 24th of 1998, Susie Mowbray was acquitted of all charges.
Wow, that was a bold move. And so this was a jury that acquitted her, yes?
Yes.
Okay. I thought maybe she did like a bench trial or something and the judge was like, no, the evidence. Okay. That is a lot. I mean, it seemed like a pretty good case. I get that the expert not being an expert, like that is damaging to the prosecution, but I still think there's a very good argument that he could not have done this to himself. The evidence just does not support that. And well, then who had access to him? There's only one person that had access to him, and that was Susie.
Right. So what I will say is it came up in that Oxygen episode that I watched. They said, you know, it wasn't that the jury didn't think that Susie killed Bill. I think that there were definitely some members of the jury that thought that, but they didn't feel that the prosecution proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And the foreman specifically read in court that the outcome of the trial was due to the improper handling of the evidence.
Fair enough, right? And there's that argument for better to let a guilty person go than, you know, have however many innocent people in jail. And I think sometimes it's unfortunate, but this ends up being a result of using experts that aren't actually experts when you clearly seem to know that that's the case. You've got someone who's internationally renowned, and you're choosing to use this Heskew person instead. So I feel like it was a really poor choice on the part of the prosecution. And they ended up getting an L from this rather than their initial W. They're like, yeah, we're going to take a win, but not so fast because Susie's son was very dedicated to his mother. And he did what is so hard to do is get this conviction turned around. And she was acquitted. Like, I can't even believe that based on what we know. But I get their point that there just might not have been enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt coupled with Heskew. Ugh, it's just super frustrating though.
It is. And it, you know, of course now, because we sort of have this acquittal now, we're done. You know, they don't get to come back and say, we're going to try you again for this. Like they had their opportunity and they lost. And to know that you lost because of your own like conduct, it's got to make you stop and think at some point.
I mean, not only is that embarrassing, but it's got to be kind of damaging to the career of a prosecutor too, even if just in the short term, because it's not good from an optics perspective.
Right. It's not just that you lost the case. It's like they're calling you out because of the way you handled and processed the case.
Lack of integrity type of a thing.
Right. And that never looks good. I mean, prosecutors already have this kind of, they'll do everything like to get a win. You know, they'll stop at nothing to get a win. So to have this kind of come out, it's like, well, apparently everything includes mishandling evidence and hiring experts who aren't even doing scientific testing.
Yeah, they could have done a better job, but they were more concerned with getting a win than handling the case properly and in a way that was the most ethical, right? I mean, one could argue that it was unethical to, you know, handle things the way they did, knowing that Heskew wasn't the type of expert that they were wanting him to be, but yet they went ahead with it anyways. That was a poor choice.
Right. And I think we see now, like, what the consequences of that choice are. You know, if you're going to make the choice to have that kind of an expert, you're going to be stuck with the consequences of him eventually admitting that what he did initially wasn't scientific.
But I think 9 out of 10 times, they probably get away with it because most people are never granted a new trial. That's where Susie got real lucky here.
And I think it wasn't one thing in particular. It was like that totality of circumstances.
Yeah, definitely.
Where you have multiple lab techs and Heskew. And then you also have the suppression of the report from McDonald. Like, all of these things added up. It wasn't just that she had one thing.
They don't have their stuff together at all. You're not handling things in a scientific manner, but you're presenting it like you are. So we're questioning your integrity and your ability to present things that are based in fact. Now everything is going to be almost tainted, right? It's all going to be coming from these people who lied to us about these other things. So I can see why the jury reached the conclusion that they did, however frustrating it is for us who are looking at it now.
And I think at the end of the day, you should want a prosecution that's going to bring a case where you don't have reasonable doubt, like as best as you can. You know, obviously the defense is always going to try to argue that there's reasonable doubt. But when you're literally handing them reasonable doubt because you don't have qualified experts.
Yeah, it's only their own fault, right? They only have themselves to blame here. And unfortunately for the family of Bill, you know, surviving Kristen, she's probably left in just emotional upheaval, right? Because everything that she thought was already put to bed, the fact that Susie had murdered her father, well, that's been thrown out now. So what justice does she get for her father?
So she was, you know, extremely disappointed by the verdict in the second trial. And she even said that she felt like Susie literally got away with her father's murder.
Yeah, I could see why she felt that way. And I can't imagine the type of impact that must have had on her. Because you feel like, you know, this is wrapped up and you've got a resolution. I mean, closure's not really something that's easy to get, right? But it's resolved. Your father is dead, but the person who did this to him is in jail. And then when she leaves, I don't know how you deal with that. I don't know how you process not only your grief, but your anger.
Right. It's like you said, you had resolution to some extent, and then you had everything kind of unravel, but then she gets this new trial and you're like, okay, well, you know, the prosecution can still make their arguments, try to make their case, but then to have an acquittal based on the fact that the prosecution and the police mishandled evidence, that's gotta like make you super pissed off at them. Why didn't you handle this scene properly from the beginning and treat it like you should have from the very beginning?
Yeah, and that's the unintended consequences of a win-at-all-costs mentality.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, you know, like you said, Bill and Kristen are the ones who lose. You know, Bill lost his life, whether suicide, accident, murder, whatever you think happened, he's no longer here. And his daughter has no answers as to why.
Yeah, my heart really goes out to Kristen because in my mind, it's pretty clear what happened here. And just in my personal opinion, it's a miscarriage of justice. But the fault and the blame lay on the shoulders of the prosecution here because this would have never been overturned. She would have never got a new trial had they not used Heskew and these lab techs for their unscientific tests.
Yeah. So after the second trial, Susie brought what is called a 1983 action for a civil rights violation, which is basically a wrongful conviction lawsuit. So she named the county, the three prosecutors, three police officers, and the county lab technician, all of whom participated in the trial. She also, classy lady that she is, she sued her husband's heirs in order to try and regain the life insurance policy.
Gross.
Yes. This one, like you said, super gross, but two, it also like still doesn't make you look good.
No. It's like, what do you care more about, proving that you're innocent, or do you care about regaining this money that you think is rightfully yours? I just don't like that. I mean, I get if she actually is innocent, that she would fight for the overturning of the conviction and the suing of, you know, the state, the city, the prosecutors. I totally get that. But it's the suing of the heirs and re-traumatizing them that really bothers me.
Yeah, it's at this point, it's like it's been 10 years, 11 years since the death of Bill. Just move on at this point, you know?
Yeah. The fact that you're willing to drag them through the mud and through another court process just for, you know, your own financial gain, which is a long shot anyways. So I don't know. It's just not a good look.
Right. So the court dismissed all of her 1983 claims because police officers and other state actors, for the most part, have some kind of qualified immunity that protects them from civil actions if they're in the furtherance of their duties as a state actor. So this also includes prosecutors. They have prosecutorial immunity, which is a very similar thing. There definitely are exceptions, but like I said, if you're kind of acting just in the furtherance of your duties in your job, you're usually pretty shielded. And so basically, I think that the reason her case was dismissed is that there's no real smoking gun kind of exonerating her or establishing that any of the prosecutors or lab techs were like out to get her. I think that obviously the case was mishandled, but I more see that as kind of like a negligence and intelligence kind of argument versus like them being malicious in their prosecution of her.
I think sometimes when you want to win, you will ignore certain facts. And, you know, maybe that was the fact that Heskew wasn't doing things right. Maybe they didn't ask enough questions about his methods and how scientific they were. I don't know if it was just negligence or if they on purpose tried to withhold the other expert's testimony and, you know, kind of bury that with a bunch of other things and push him forward in a way that they're trying to be deceptive. I mean, whether that's acting with integrity or not is, you know, not for me to decide. But I think if they would have acted differently, there might have been a different outcome. But it seemed like getting a win was the most important thing. And I think that's a difficult thing to balance, right? Wanting to win and doing whatever you can to win versus, you know, keeping your ethics intact. I think you're walking a tightrope with that if you're in the position of prosecutor all the time. And I think that's why they have prosecutorial immunity, because people make mistakes sometimes. And when you're doing a large case, it's easy to make mistakes. And even with those Brady violations, when they withhold exculpatory evidence, you often never see them getting punished for it, because I think it's just, it's like with police officers being protected from making mistakes, or when there's a shooting where we think like, oh, they should be charged for that, but they're protected because they're, you know, acting, like you said, as a state actor. So they're shielded from those sorts of things.
I just, you know, did an episode with another podcast about wrongful convictions in particular. And so we talked in that case about wrongful conviction lawsuits filed afterwards. And in the case we talked about, there was very clear evidence of innocence. And in my mind, in Susie's case, I don't see that. There, to me, like the judge said when he granted her a new trial, I still feel like there's evidence that either Bill committed suicide or she killed him. But I don't think that there's evidence very clearly one way or another.
Yeah, I think that there's not really the argument for innocence here and the wrongful conviction as there is. Sure, she was acquitted of the charges because of the state's, you know, misconduct or however you want to frame that with regards to Heskew and the other lab techs. So it's not clear there was evidence to support her innocence so much as they kind of screwed up and they're paying for it. And she maybe got lucky here because the jury was like, we didn't like what the state did with the experts and, you know, it makes them question the integrity of everything. So I don't think that's the same as a wrongful conviction and her being actually innocent.
And I think that's important to note because, you know, as I said, we were discussing exonerations in this episode. And one of the important things is in order to actually be exonerated of a crime, you have to have some kind of evidence of innocence. And that to me is just not clear in this case.
No, it feels ballsy that she even wants to go forward with it.
It does. And I think it just, I'm sure part of it was like her son, you know, saying, oh, you've been acquitted and you served this time in prison and you should be compensated for that. And it's like, yeah, it sucks. But at the same time, like you said, you just happen to get lucky this second time. Like if there hadn't been that prosecutorial misconduct and the mishandling of evidence, it very well could have gone the other way the second time too.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's her son. Like he's devoted his whole life to becoming a lawyer so he could have this moment to free his mother. And he succeeded. And the entire trajectory of his life has been shaped by her potential actions. You know, if you were to believe that she is responsible. And so if he's then saying, I think you should take this one step further and we should have this, you know, be wrongful conviction and maybe you'll get some kind of monetary reward for it. And he's pushing for all these things. Maybe she's just kind of acquiescing to whatever he wants because he's given up so much to fight for her.
Yeah. And I mean, at this point, what's it going to hurt, I guess, is an argument to be made too. Why not try it?
Yeah. They can't try her again at this point. So what do they really have to lose except for, you know, losing face?
Right. And I mean, she truly didn't seem to care about that.
No, obviously not. If she's going to go after the inheritance of Kristen, she doesn't care.
Exactly. So at this point, it's just a last-ditch effort to kind of, you know, make up for that. But again, in my mind, what we should be using wrongful compensation lawsuits and wrongful compensation funds for is people who were actually innocent.
I thought it was like you couldn't file a lawsuit unless you were exonerated. I thought when you were just acquitted, you couldn't unless you were actually like exonerated of the crime.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think anybody can file any kind of lawsuit, but
it is America.
Yes. So that's essentially what the judge was saying when he threw out her claims is that you haven't shown any kind of evidence that gets you beyond the immunity to where you can sue these people for, you know, the reasons we've been talking about. There is no evidence of innocence in this case that's so like clear cut that we see in other cases.
Yeah, that makes sense. I could totally see why the judge came to that conclusion because also the state doesn't like to pay out unless it's very, very clear that that person is innocent.
And, you know, like I said, that's rightfully so. We shouldn't be paying people when it's something that could go either way. And to me, that's why I think they have that evidence of innocence really defining exoneration, because it's looking at everything that's available and saying, there's no way that this person committed this crime. And in her case, if you look at the nightgown, you look at the blood spatter, you look at her actions, who she called, when she called, like all the things of the case, to me, I think you can go either way, but I definitely cannot say for sure that she is innocent.
I think you can eliminate the nightgown. And I think most people that are hearing the story, not a jury, because you have a different kind of burden on you as a jury with what is going to help you reach your conclusion. But as a, you know, just a typical layperson listening to this case, I think it's very easy to draw the conclusion that she did it.
I think so. And in my mind, it's like, I still do have a lot of questions about, you know, why there's no blood or brain matter on her I can, you know, concede that she cleaned herself off, but even just the way that she's kind of describing what happened, I'm still not really sure what positioning she would have been in if she had done it. Like, it still is just so confusing to me.
And a lot of those things could have been answered if it was investigated as a crime and the scene was properly photographed, forensically tested right in that moment. Even the blood spatter on the wall, which she got to paint over. So many of these things could help fill in the puzzle pieces. And say that they thought it was a murder. Well, then maybe they would get a warrant to search the entire home. And maybe there was a bag with clothing in which she was wearing to murder Bill. But yet, this is something that she potentially had a chance to dispose of, if it indeed existed, before the police came back to do their evidence sweep the next day, because they basically just left her to it and were like, we'll come back the next day to collect further evidence.
And that's, like you said, that's something we're never going to know, because she's obviously never going to say, I took off all of my bloody clothes and I threw them in a dumpster on 7th Street or whatever. You know, like, she's never going to say something like that. And because they never investigated it like an actual crime, I truly could not find what level of investigation they did. I know that there were some pictures taken, the sheets and the covers and her nightgown were taken, but I have no idea what other things were taken or what other pictures were taken or avenues they explored. Like, did they check in any trash? Like, if you're treating it as a suicide, I mean, I would posit a guess that you didn't do those things, but that's why I think it's so important to treat a case like it's a homicide, because otherwise you're, like you said, you're just giving her the opportunity because you've left her to her own devices for the evening. Okay, like, why wouldn't she go throw away all of the incriminating evidence?
Yeah, and I mean, you could also say she might have time to do it before. She could have hid it, you know, elsewhere, because Bill was alive. It's not like time of death helps us with what time she did this. Do you know what I mean? Like, it makes it a little more vague because he was still alive then. He could have been alive for 2 hours. I mean, if he's continually bleeding, the blood probably won't be dry because it's pooling in places. And I mean, I don't know how carefully they checked that, because they believed it was a suicide. So I don't think they were checking how dry blood spatter was in certain places.
That's something I was kind of, I couldn't quite word it before, but I definitely was thinking about, was just because he was alive when they found him, like, that didn't necessarily mean he had just been shot. It's like you said, he could have like slowly been bleeding out for who knows how long.
Oh, totally. And not all head wounds result in death. So this could have been a head wound that perhaps he could have survived had there been the appropriate medical intervention in, you know, kind of an expedient manner. But we just don't know how much time lapsed between the shooting and then the phone call to the business partner.
Right. And I never found any information on that, like when the two calls took place, how much time was between the two. I mean, she definitely could have made the calls like back to back, and she could have waited to even make the business partner call for, you know, hours on end. I didn't find any information about that. And in my mind, there's still so much evidence that I wish we had, but we obviously never could have, because they never took a good hard look at the case.
Yeah. And I think it's that argument for, like you said, just having them investigate it as a crime and then letting the evidence lead them in whatever direction it is. And I think you can handle this in a very empathetic way. You get a victim's advocate, you have them sit with the surviving family member and talk with her before police do their interview. But I think you want to get a proper interview done that night. You want to make sure that you're doing it as gently as possible, because this person, if they aren't responsible, has endured a great deal of trauma. So you want to tread lightly. But I also think you don't want to step away from that scene, which could hold vital clues as to what happened. You don't want to make assumptions based on what that one person is saying, because this is incredibly atypical from the jump. And so you would hope that they would have gone, okay, we're going to just treat this as a crime scene. But they took her word for it. And, you know, she's probably giving them reason to believe that this could be true. There was a prior suicide attempt, the financial situation. Susie's probably telling them that everything, you know, on their checklist is present. And they're taking everything she's saying at face value. And they're probably trying to be very compassionate to what she's just possibly endured. And their minds might not have initially jumped to, what if she did this? But you'd like to hope that somebody there would have thought that.
Exactly. And one other thing that I never really got confirmation of was how much of a statement they got from her. Like, they obviously got her explanation about his elbow being over his head and she reaches over and touches him and then the gun goes off. They got that from her, but I don't know how much else they got from her, like how extensive her statement was. And I'm obviously not an investigator, so I don't know how they sort of proceed in a suicide, like what kind of statement they take. But I would hope that you would still want to take a comprehensive statement from the only other person who was there.
Yeah, one would hope, right? You'd think even if it is a suicide, you want to get down a very clear recollection of exactly what happened. What were the events leading up to this? What was his mental state? You want to make sure that you've got all of your details nailed down because, as you know, unless you've processed the evidence, you don't really know what happened. You're going off experience, you're going off gut when you first walk into it, and then you're going off what the surviving person is saying happened. But there's so many other things that are going to contribute to what actually happened that you don't have the ability to assess with your naked eye.
Right. And I mean, even if you're just looking at, okay, this is a suicide, I would think that you would want to still kind of conduct a halfway decent investigation because if you're, you know, thinking this is suicide, you probably want the family to receive the insurance money. And so maybe you should investigate all the avenues because maybe they have an insurance clause that doesn't allow a payout. So maybe we want to try to like help the family as best we can. So let's investigate this like it's a murder just in case, because maybe we can get a loophole for the family and also actually do our jobs.
Yeah, that was my thoughts too. In case there's any insurance issues, you want to make sure that you've conducted at least some kind of investigation to prove this is what we think happened. This is a credible scenario. And it just seems like some things fell through the cracks here.
Yeah. And I think it's such a problem when investigators have tunnel vision as to how a case is. And like you said, don't let the evidence lead them to what happened. It's such a problem that you can't undo. You know, by the time, even just the next day when they come back, things have changed dramatically.
Yeah. She wouldn't have had the ability to clean up that blood spatter with her friends if they didn't give her that like one day reprieve. Hey, we'll come back tomorrow. And she speedily was like, okay, I'm just going to clean up all of this blood here. So they could have got a much maybe better idea of what happened at that scene had they reacted in a more reasonable time frame, aka when they arrived at the scene. They should have never left.
Exactly. I understand like wanting to strike the balance between being respectful and, you know, giving the family time. But also, like, if my family member was actually like murdered, I want you to do your job. Like, I want you to respect me, sure, but I also like want you to investigate the scene, close it off. Like, I want you to treat this like it's a very serious thing. And, you know, I obviously need time to grieve and I need time to process, but I understand that you also have a job to do. And I want you to be able to do that job in the best way possible.
Yeah, please cross your T's, dot your I's, cover all of your bases so that if this ever needs to be revisited at a later date, you've got the information to do so thoroughly.
Right, because it's like we've talked about, you can't go back and try to recreate the story. You know, you have to do it that first time when you've arrived on scene. That's all I have for you. Like I said, when I came across this case, my mind was just like blown. So I can tell you now, since we've talked about it, that I saw it on Accident, Suicide, or Murder on Oxygen, which is just a fascinating series. If you haven't watched it, I highly recommend it. They definitely have some like super twisty, turny cases that they cover.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it out because I'm really into cases where there is just no clear-cut answer. And I think it's just because our human brain wants to fill in the gaps and wants to solve that puzzle. But I always feel so deeply for the surviving family members that are left behind with these tragedies without proper clear-cut answers, especially when they feel like there wasn't a proper investigation or there wasn't an adequate investigation done. So they just don't feel like they can ever get the proper answers. So I'll definitely check out that series. So Elise, do you want to tell us a little bit about your show, True Crime Cat Lawyer?
Yes. So I cover true crime cases from the Pacific Northwest. And just for reference, we define the Pacific Northwest as Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia. So we cover serial killers, unsolved murders, missing persons from that region. We release episodes every other Thursday, and we are pretty much on every platform that you can think of to listen to podcasts. And you can check us out on social media as well. You can look up True Crime Cat Lawyer on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and True Crime Cat Law on Twitter.
And when Elise says we, she means her and her cat, Winston, who is also a female, which is like the cutest thing ever.
Yes, she is the face of the podcast and definitely the one who runs the show. I'm just working here as one of her minions.
Isn't that how that works? Being a Winston mom.
Oh, yes. She definitely runs a tight ship and it's her way or the highway.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Elise, for coming on the show and telling me about this very complex case that definitely left me scratching my head at parts. But in the end, I think I definitely have an opinion and it's pretty clear to everybody who's listening.
Yes. And I so appreciate you being a willing listener in this story and letting me take you on this wild and strange ride. Like I said, this case like just jumped out at me and I'm so excited that I got to share it with you because I so often I'm alone on my cases. And so it's nice to have somebody to be able to like chat through these like crazy cases with.
Oh, I know. It's so good to have a sounding board sometimes, isn't it? When you think something and you're like, yes, this person agrees with me. I'm not wrong.
Yeah. And just we've had this like super good discussion the whole time. It's nice to have that, especially in a case where there's just so many questions and head scratching points.
Yeah. And it's also good when people are like affirming when you're right, but it's also good when they're telling you like, hey, it could be this way. So you can start to see things a different way when you get a good discussion going like we just did.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I truly love doing these collaborations for.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things too. It's really fun to connect with somebody and to talk about cases because in the end, you always feel like you've got a greater understanding.
Yes, and I definitely have, you know, different perspectives as well.
I want to thank everybody for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode and you're interested in joining the Patreon, I will leave the links in the show notes below. So I want to thank my editor, Elisa, who goes by the name of Smy, and I'll link her music in the show notes as well. Until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything.